Sunday Night Science.
Well, if you're into watching crime shows on TV, you're probably well aware that we leave traces of ourselves pretty much wherever we go. Take a drink of water, and your DNA is on the lip of the cup you drank from. Scratch your head, and tiny little bits of your genetic code are now floating through the air and could end up almost, well, anywhere, really. But we're not the only ones who leave genetic traces in our wake. Tonight on Sunday Night Science, we're looking at the world of environmental, or eDNA, as it's called. They're the little bits of DNA left around the place by animals and plants. We're going to explore how it's been used for conservation, for pest control, and even to warn you when you might get your next allergy attack. Now, to help explain it all, we are joined by Linda Byfen, who is a science communicator at the Australian Science Media Centre. Hello, Linda. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Good evening, Suzanne.
So explain to us just what eDNA is.
So that's right, we all shed these bits of DNA during a day. So the average person, for example, loses, I think, about 40,000 skin cells every hour, which is enough to make you want to vacuum your couch straight away. But animals and every living thing essentially, you know, can shed bits of their DNA. So from animals, we're talking about, you know, weeing and pooing and things like that, and also skin cells from their mucous membranes, their nose and mouth, or even dead animals in the environment. And all of that sort of biological material hangs around in the environment and is sort of evidence of what is and isn't present in that particular environment, sort of like nature's little genetic fingerprint. And so scientists are now at the point where they can start using those bits of DNA left around in the environment to maybe look for one particular species or to go into a particular area and have a look at all the different species that are there.
How long does DNA survive for? I mean, I guess it's depending on whether it's a skin cell or a piece of hair. I'm just wondering whether when you sample the DNA soup that we're swimming around in, how old some of that could be.
Well, it definitely depends on where you're looking. So a lot of the work on eDNA has been done in water. And water is quite good because it really can give you a snapshot of that particular point in time, because DNA in water starts to break down really in a matter of days. So it's a very much a what is in that watery environment at that particular time. But if you're looking at soil or something like ice, it can last for thousands of years. So we can also use this eDNA to tell us about ancient ecosystems.
Oh, okay. So look, it feels like we've been swabbing crime scenes for DNA for decades. So why are we only just starting to use this technology on environmental samples?
That's right. But I don't know if any of your listeners will be familiar with the Human Genome Project. They might remember that, from sort of 20 years ago. And it really took us 20 years and about $4 billion to sequence the first human genome, so all of human DNA from one particular human. And that was a huge undertaking. Fast forward 20 years, and now the cost of sequencing has come down, a bit like our mobile phones get smaller and, you know, faster over the years, so does DNA sequencing. And now to sequence a human's DNA it is less than $1,000. So all of that sequencing technology has got much faster and much cheaper. So we're almost at the point where we can, use it in almost this sort of disposable way to go out and take a sample and get a quick DNA result.
Linda, I guess it also would mean that we are building up reference libraries for all sorts of DNA from animals and plants as well as from humans.
Yeah, that's right. And we're even using these sort of environmental samples to build new reference libraries. So recently some Australian scientists helped boost what we know about the bacteria that live on and around us by deciphering the DNA of 12,000 new species from 50,000 environmental DNA samples that they collected. So, you know, sometimes we need these really good reference laboratories to be able to match it and tell us what's there. But we can also use these new samples that are coming in to build up some of these references.
Lintel, look, scientists have been out in the field for a very long time, logging and re-recording plants and animals in the environment for a long time without needing this kind of technology. So why would you want to use eDNA sampling? What's the benefit of it?
I think one of the benefits is it can be quite quick and cheap and fast. So if you think about how long you might have to sit and wait, you know, patiently in the dark and cold of some forest in the hope of catching a glimpse of a particular animal, whereas you might be able to take a sample of soil, take it back to the lab and know straight away whether that animal had been in that environment. So it's got the potential to be much faster, and it also means that you don't need to be an expert to capture some of this stuff. So it means scientists can use park rangers or even just, you know, average Joes like us to go out into our community and go out into our local environment, maybe get a sample of your local waterway, and you can contribute to research projects that are going on.
Could the collection of DNA indicate how many of a particular plant or animal is in an area, or will it just indicate that there's been at least one there?
We're getting closer to be able to do that. So, you know, the question, I guess that's the area where there's a fair bit of uncertainty because there's so many things that could affect how well you're able to essentially replicate that DNA. Part of the test is to replicate the DNA and get enough that it shows up. And there's lots of things that could affect that. And one could be how much of that animal is in the environment, but there could be a host of other things affecting it. So that's one of the places where we need to do a lot more research, is around how reliable some of this data is and whether we can use it to not just say the animal was there, but how much of that animal or plant was there.
Yeah, I was just thinking, Lindell, about some stories a couple of years ago saying that there was almost a massive extermination of insects going on. But when we spoke to experts, they were saying, look, we think the mass of insects has reduced, but it's really hard to measure insects because they're so very small. So I was wondering whether something like this could be useful in something like measuring insects.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the projects that a group of researchers are doing. They're actually looking at plants that pollinating insects visit. And by sampling those plants, they can actually tell which insect pollinators have been on that particular plant. And they can track that over time and see whether it's changing, going up, going down, and also which particular species of insect are most important for that particular crop.
Lindell, eDNA is being used on several conservation projects here in Australia. Tell us about how it's being used with the platypus in Queensland.
Yeah, so the rivers around Brisbane were sort of once home to quite a lot of platypus. So there were platypus species in lots of the waterways surrounding Brisbane. But platypus are a pretty elusive creature and one of those difficult ones to study. You know, they don't like people. They tend to stay away from researchers that are in the area, so they can be a bit hard to research. So a group of scientists from the University of Queensland have actually been using eDNA in the rivers around Brisbane, and they've looked for platypus DNA in 54 waterways and essentially found that five of those that used to have platypus there, they couldn't find any sign of platypus from their water sampling. So that's an indication that those species that once were there are no longer in those waterways. And some of them are around the more sort of developed parts of Brisbane.
All right. Well, that tells a story, doesn't it? I think, Lindell, there's a similar citizen science project that's been launched in Victoria recently.
There is. So if you live in Victoria and you want to, you know, take part in this project, you can actually just Google eDNA and Platypus Victoria and you'll find it. But you can go out into your local waterway and take a sample of water and contribute, because they're keen to see how platypus are faring around Victoria. Generally, platypus in Australia are not doing very well. So really, this is crucial information for a species that's under a lot of threat.
So, I mean, you just talked about taking samples of water. How else would you take the samples? I mean, I'm just imagining DNA could be anywhere, right? On a bit of the soil on that tree over there. How do you figure out that you've got enough of a range of locations and samples to check whether something has been there?
Yeah, and I guess the reason I'm talking about water is because the beauty of water is it acts like a sort of beautiful little DNA soup. So, you know, anything that's been in that water is likely to have left behind some DNA, and you can filter a huge amount of water, and take that DNA out of it quite easily. You essentially, you know, have a little bit of filter paper in your container and you pour the water through and the DNA gets trapped on that bit of filter. That's a bit harder with soil. You can't sort of pour soil through filters, but you still can get eDNA from soils. We can get it from ice. A whole host of really anything that could be in the environment can be in dust, household dust, anything like that.
It's also used in pest management, eDNA, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And you can imagine that it's very useful for picking up invasive species, because what you're really looking for there is either a species is in the environment or it's not in the environment. And we know that if it's in the environment and it's invasive, then it's going to become a big problem. So one of the things that we're looking at the moment, there's a team at James Cook Uni in Queensland who's been doing a long-running eDNA study looking for tilapia, which were once a sort of popular aquarium fish in Australia. They're now banned because they're so invasive. And they've been taking over tropical waterways in Queensland. They're already in 21 of the 76 catchments that they have up there. So they're really highly invasive. So by looking for tiny amounts of their eDNA in the waterways that they're not in, it's really like a sort of early warning system for when they have got into their waterways, and we can start, you know, enacting sort of destruction and methods to kind of get rid of them or keep them as far back as we can.
Right. I suppose you could do something similar with a cane toad, couldn't you? See if it's which waterways their DNA is appearing in.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So there's a whole host of invasive species that we could use this technology for.
Yeah, really interesting. So we've talked about it in water. We've said we can use it on land as well. So it's used in counterterrorism too, Linda.
That's right. So, I mean, this is almost going full circle to looking at, you know, DNA and crime scenes and that sort of thing. But there's a group here at Flinders University in South Australia looking at dust on soil profiles and things like that might be able to tell us which particular country a person has spent time in, or have they been to a particular area. I'm sure listeners will remember the Salisbury Cathedral poisonings a couple of years ago. You know, there is that sort of case where you could look at the soil that's on the shoes or the dust on the luggage of these particular suspects and know whether they then went into that area on the basis of the DNA that's in their belongings.
Oh, wow, fascinating. I've got Anne on the line, Lyndall. Hello, Anne.
Hello, ladies. How are you?
Good. Now, you're wondering about some other potential uses of eDNA.
Yes, the wood hens on Lord Howe Island are in decline, and Sean Dorney said they're going to do a rat eradication program later this year. And I was wondering if the DNA of the rats could be changed to stop them breeding.
Sorry, I didn't quite get it. The DNA of the rats could be changed, was that the question?
Could be changed to stop them breeding so that they don't reproduce.
Yeah, so this is a slightly different type of use of DNA, and something that we call gene drives, which is essentially what you could do, and this is something that scientists have been looking at with mice and rat populations on other islands, is you essentially put a single gene into a mice or a rat that makes them infertile, and then along with it you put an extra gene that means that they definitely pass that particular piece of DNA to their offspring, and so it sort of drives that particular gene through all their children, and eventually they become sterile. So those, you know, it sounds like a great solution, but we also then have to be able to control where that piece of DNA goes and make sure that it doesn't then escape into, you know, native animal populations. So it's definitely a type of control that scientists are looking at. But we're, you know, very careful about ever releasing anything like this into the environment. So still at the research stage at the moment for a lot of this stuff.
And I know Lord Howe has had real success in actually getting rid of some of those invasive species, haven't they?
I'm only going on what Sean Dorney said, because it was funny when he talked to Richard Fadler, and he said that he hadn't seen a wood hen, and he found on his song playlist Neil Diamond's Hot August Night, and said, "Good Lord," and the and the wood hens came out. But he said there's only 30 pairs left on the island.
Oh, how interesting. That was a fairly recent report you saw, was it?
No, it was on Richard Fadler's The Conversation Hour.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'm just having a little look because I know, in fact, I've just found a story about a wood hen, but I might need to have a read of that. But I'm sure there's been a lot of good news lately, Anne, out of Lord Howe Island. So perhaps things are actually already going in the wood hen's favour there, but we'll have a look. Now, I want to bring Nick Osborne into the conversation here. To contribute on this one. Associate Professor Nick Osborne is an epidemiologist and toxicologist at the School of Public Health at the University of Queensland, because there are some other ways that we can apply environmental DNA, which might be of a big help to us. Hello, Nick. How are you doing?
Hi, Suzanne. I'm very well.
Now, tell us about, because you work on things in the environment and the environment and the way that it impacts on our health. How much is eDNA becoming part of the work that you do?
Well, more and more, it's a fantastic tool, and as we've just heard, we applied for many different ways. I've got an interest in looking at the relationship between pollen and health outcomes. So every year, I'm sure many of us are aware that getting exposed to pollen can drive things like rhinitis and hay fever, but also more serious asthma exacerbations. And one of the things that we've sort of struggled with is grass pollen. So if we look down a microscope at tree pollen, we can separate out all the different trees, but grass pollen tends to look the same. But we know there's, you know, 1,000-odd species of grasses in Australia alone. And so we're interested if there was particular species of grass would contribute more to hay fever or pollen than others. And that was the sort of question that we had. And eDNA is a tool that allows us, of course, to separate out the individual species of grass. And we've just completed a big study in the UK, and we found that some grasses did appear to be more likely to cause health outcomes.
It's kind of interesting that we didn't know which grasses were likely to have a bigger impact than others. Was it strange to you that was something we still didn't know?
Well, you can sort of guess, because you can see the pollen coming off of particular species, like a reed or ryegrass at a particular time of year. But of course, the pollen moves around as well. So the pollen you're actually exposed to, probably most of it comes from, you know, within a kilometre of where you are. But pollen also has the ability to travel vast distances, so it might have come from far away.
So what do we know now, Nick, about which grasses are the ones that we want to avoid, the main culprits?
What it sort of has told us, there's several culprits, and we certainly need to do some more research. There's a couple of species that we found in the UK. They're not very common in Australia. We were thinking that species like ryegrass that was obviously that's been implicated with the thunderstorm asthma down in Melbourne, we thought that might be a major culprit. But it doesn't seem to be. And so this has got us scratching our heads. So we're certainly going to have to go back and do some more research on this.
So what else could you gather by using eDNA? Is there any more information that you can get?
Well, grasses are very complicated organisms, and many of the grasses we use in Australia have been brought in for overseas. So, you know, thinking about the you know, stuff that cows and sheep eat tend to be not the native grasses. And they've been bred in certain crossbred over many centuries to you have good agricultural yields. And because of this, they're very complicated. So we may actually be able to come up with a grass that's less allergenic into the future. The other thing that we're sort of really interested in is timing. One of the big things, because I'm interested in the health outcomes, being able to forewarn people on particular days that their allergy or their asthma might be exacerbated, by forewarning them, they can have their medications ready, they can stay indoors, they can avoid exercise on that day. And that means their risk of asthma exacerbation and ending up in hospital can be dramatically reduced.
I guess that relies, though, on people taking samples of this stuff on a daily basis, a pollen monitoring centre. How is that done at the moment anyway?
At the moment, you have people collecting every day. There's a reader that's got basically every hour collects some pollen on it, and then the next day they take the tape off and they read that by looking down a microscope. So very, very labour intensive. There's a few automated machines just starting to come on to the market that use lasers. But this eDNA, one thing about it, it's fairly labour in it. Doesn't take a lot of labour to do. So maybe this is another pathway we can explore.
Yeah. I'd imagine at the moment, though, Nick, we're saying pollen's high. We're not saying particular, the ryegrass is up, or, you know, this particular grass that's really bad is up on this day. Is that right? We're giving a more general sort of account of what's going on with the pollen?
Yeah. So what's reported, I suppose, you know, in the weather services and in the newspaper is just total pollen. That can be broken down. The tree pollens tend to be a little less allergenic and not to be, don't cause so much allergy. The grass pollens seem to be particularly allergenic, and there might be certain species. So instead of just having that total saying all pollen is high, we're talking about sort of personalised medicine moving into the future, that a person that's has an allergy to a particular species, and remember, our immune system is very finely tuned and can tell the difference between, say, a walnut and a pecan and a hazelnut. The same sort of thing could be happening with grasses. And so that means, you know, you might get a text on through to your phone saying tomorrow the particular species that you're allergic to is going to be very high. So that's the day that you need to look out. So it's about having that sort of personalised approach to medicine and warnings.
Nick Osborne with us, Associate Professor, Epidemiologist and Toxologist at the School of Public Health at the University of Queensland, and also Linda Byford, who is a science communicator at the Australian Science Media Centre. Now, Linda, what do you know? What can you tell us about how you get accurate samples for pollen? Because we've talked about some of the challenges of getting these DNA samples.
Well, that's right. And I imagine pollen is probably not the easiest thing to sample. I was interested, actually, if Nick had any thoughts of, I know the difficulty with pollen is that we don't have particularly great records in Australia, but even in the Northern Hemisphere, they're now sort of looking at some predictions that it's likely to increase quite substantially in the future with things like climate change. I'm just wondering whether Nick's planning on using eDNA to kind of monitor potentially those sorts of changes that we might see into the future with climate change.
Yeah, certainly. Well, we know we live in a changing environment. Many climates are going to be hotter. Many will be potentially wetter. So a lot of these things contribute to and have more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere as well. And some preliminary experiments that people have done have found that having extra carbon dioxide, so extra carbon for the plant being available, makes the pollen more allergenic. We think about the growing seasons. You know, at the moment our pollen season, well, for grasses might kick off sort of October time and be sort of done by Christmas. But imagine if the pollen season was twice as long. So that means it has the potential to have twice as much effect on health. And being able to monitor those individual species by using a tool such as eDNA, when you look at a grass pollen sample, you know whether you're looking at a very highly allergenic species or one that just isn't so important for health outcomes.
So, and Nick, your research is broader than just pollen. I think you're looking at the eDNA fingerprint of green space. Explain that to us.
Yeah, well, another of my research interests is some of the good things we get from the environment. So being exposed to green space has been pretty heavily researched over the last 10 years, and we're still sort of trying to work out why going to parks and gardens or having them around our houses is good for us. I mean, we build them into our infrastructure of our cities, we go on holidays, we undergo tree change. There's multiple reasons why that might be occurring. It might be just the factor that you're out exercising more, you might be getting more vitamin D. It seems to have quite a good psychological effect. And one of the sort of hypothesis of how this works is our gut flora and our skin flora, so the little microbes that live on our skin and in our gut, we know if they're biodiverse, we tend to be healthier people. And that there's a strong interaction between the gut and the brain, but also the gut and the immune system. So having a healthy immune system, you really have to have a good gut flora living in you. So the question comes, well, where do we get this good gut flora? And our hypothesis is being in contact with a biodiverse environment, so an old growth forest or something, you can imagine a lot of different bacteria coming into contact with that with humans means that we're going to be healthier in the long run. And so we're going to be using eDNA to explore this. And we know there's a link between green space and health, but a lot of green space at the moment is purely measured as a green blob on the map. So it's like saying a cricket field is the same as a forest. Now, that we know green space is going to be different, but actually by going out there and using eDNA to measure that biodiversity means we've got an extra tool that we can examine that relationship between our health and especially around diseases that are influenced by our immune system, so inflammatory type of diseases, of which allergy and asthma are two of them.
So where will you be going? I guess you want to be going and taking samples in various parks to try and test this theory?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we're, because we want to measure it up with some human health studies, there's a number of those being run across Brisbane that have excellent measures of health outcomes such as asthma. So we'll actually go and sample the parks nearby to the houses of where our participants in our studies live. And then we'll be able to actually, go out and take an air sample or a soil sample or a water sample from the parks. So there's a large area called Mount Cutha in Brisbane, which is just on the edge of the city. So we'll be sampling that as an example. But also we'll go to some more industrialised areas or some heavy residential areas where the parks might be a lot smaller. But you'd imagine also there wouldn't be too many platypus in them in some of the small parks in the inner city.
So what's your gut feeling about what you're going to find about how much of the allergies and food intolerances that we see today can be related to eDNA exposure?
Well, I think probably maybe around about 10 to 20%, which, doesn't sound like very much. We can decrease people's risk by that amount. But then you also have to consider about 20% of kids and about 10% of adults have asthma. So even a small reduction in those levels of asthma by 0.5% or so is a huge saving to the public health force. So that's my sort of feeling is that, it's going to be part of the story. It's a very complex mosaic that we're trying to pull apart. So it'll be certainly part of the story, but, I'm not, it certainly won't be a cure-all.
Yeah. Nick, thanks so much for being part of this conversation and sharing with us some of the work that you're doing on eDNA and how it relates to pollen. And we all look forward to having personalised pollen reports in the future telling us how it's likely to affect us.
Great. Great. Thanks for having me.
That's Associate Professor Nick Osborne, epidemiologist and toxicologist at the School of Public Health at the University of Queensland. Still got Lyndall Byford with me, who's the science communicator at the Australian Science Media Centre. Now, I think I've got to the bottom of Anne's call, Lyndall, because we think that was an old version of Conversations with Sean Dooley from BirthLife Australia that Anne was had been listening to, because the news that I've found... and as I thought, this is a story just from January out of the Sydney Morning Herald saying that a rat hasn't been seen on Lord Howe Island for 15 months. And the latest check on the wood hen found that there were 440, twice the number of the previous count only a year earlier. So I think that rat problem, Anne, hopefully has been solved. So that's good, isn't it, Lyndall?
It's lovely to have some good environmental news for a change.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Lyndall, to talk us through eDNA and how it works. Certainly sounds like a fairly new frontier in science, but one that's going to be really helpful in, well, helping us learn more about what's going on in our environment. So thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
That is Lyndall Byford, who is a science communicator at the Australian Science Media Centre.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.